Welcome to Light Warrior Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Kann, author of the number one best-selling book, Sensitivity is Your Superpower, How to Harness Your Gifts, Fulfill Your Purpose, and Create a Life of Joy. And I would love to gift you, if you are a highly sensitive soul like I am, my Sensitive Soul Empowerment Guide, the three ways of navigating your way to more peace, positivity, and personal power. And I would also love for you to be in our community. So the great thing is that you can get that Sensitive Soul Guide at sensitivesoulguide.com, and then you'll be on my mailing list and be able to come into our free community called the Light Medicine Community, where we can chat, have free monthly mini healings, and all sorts of fun stuff. And today on the radio show, I have a very special guest, Anthony Samaroff. He's actually a psychotherapist and an author from Glasgow, Scotland, currently in Mexico. He's writing a book on the pharmaceutical industry, and he's actually created a short ebook made up of excerpts of that particular project that he is gifting to us, available free, and it is at 7pharmamyths.com. Seven, that is the number seven, and then pharmamyths, all one word, .com. And today we're going to talk about why are we spending so much money in healthcare, but it doesn't seem like people are getting better. And in fact, we seem to be getting fatter. We seem to be having more chronic disease and more cancer, despite the war on cancer. So, you know, what is that all about? Apparently, you know, medicine, if you will, is the third leading cause of death, which sounds ridiculous, right? You got your heart disease, you got your cancer, then you got medicine. Well, as a medical doctor, I'm not very happy about that. That my profession are involved in the third leading cause of death in the USA. So I'm super happy to have Anthony here today, talking about, like, you know, what is going on with all this. What are some of the myths and misconceptions that many of us hold about medicine, about pharmaceuticals, that actually not so true? And then, like, how do we discern the science, quote unquote science, we see online? Because there's so many different opinions, right? Like, if you do a search, depending on what search engine, you know, you get different answers, littered with mainstream media, you know, sharing with us what the science is, and then yet you're hearing from other people that isn't the science. So that can be really stressful and confusing for people. So how do we kind of discern, you know, what may be more true than others? And then finally, of course, how we can start taking back our health. So without further ado, hello, Anthony. Thank you so much for being here.
Dr. Kann, it's such an honor to be invited by you onto the show, and I'm thrilled to join you today. Thank you so much.
Oh, yes, my pleasure. We're thrilled to have you. And, you know, the book that you are writing, which, of course, you're giving us an excerpt, so thank you so much for that, sounds kind of spicy.
All right.
Yeah, I think you're kind of courageous writing that book. So we're going to make sure all of our light warriors send you lots of love and protection, right? We're just going to, like, put you in a nice little bubble of love, right, so this information can get out there. So tell us about yourself. How'd you get involved in all this?
Interesting. Okay. Well, yeah, I'm a psychotherapist, a counselor, and I was working online predominantly before the whole COVID thing. So it wasn't really much of a difference to go from, like, 80% online to 100% online. And I guess I've been interested in alternative health, starting with my own personal health. From a reasonably young age, I went through a lot of alternative therapies when I was in my 20s to varying degrees. And I did actually reverse conditions that the doctors couldn't do anything for, or at least when they gave me mainstream treatments, the symptoms came back after a while. But I managed to reverse some conditions that haven't come back at all using non-mainstream approaches. And a couple of things that the mainstream doctors told me kind of put a light on for me. I mean, at one point, one of the doctors wanted to prescribe some antidepressants. I simply said, okay, well, I just have to maybe do some, you tell me what you want to put me on, and I'll do some research at home and then decide if I, and then decide. And he said, okay then, doctor. which I remember.
Yes,
being,
I have heard that. I know. It's so condescending. Mm. I apologize.
So condescending.
On behalf of my profession.
Yes, okay. It wasn't you who did it. So that made me think, well, I was surprised. I thought he'd be happy that I was taking an act of interest, but I've since been told that they don't like to do that. Then I went to an alternative practitioner who basically said a whole bunch of different symptoms which I thought were unrelated, were all my digestion. So he gave me some treatment for that, and this was actually someone who had done a PhD in the medical sciences before going down the alternative route. So he had knowledge in both worlds, or at least more than one world. And that worked for a while, and I saw that that was kind of like more of a systemic approach and made me think that he knew more, like he thought of things systemically rather than just on the level of the symptoms, said, you know,
if we look
at the fundamental systems, which now I know to be things like the digestion, the liver, you know, the detoxification organs and whatnot. So that gave me a little bit of insight as well. Fast forward a little while, and I became well known in the libertarian community for writing about economics. When I was in college, I used to love theater, and I'd review plays and musicals, operas, theater productions, dance, all this stuff. I cut my teeth as a writer doing that, and it gave me an accessible style, because when you write a review, you always have to have an angle, right? So
mm-hmm.
let's just say that the economics profession is not known for their punchy, accessible style. So when I started writing about economics, people really liked my articles, because I wrote them like I was writing a theatre review. And I wrote a book, and I kind of became known in that community. And I'd been writing a little bit in healthcare, but most of it had not come to the surface. So it wasn't doing that much in my hard drive. During the course of the whole COVID debacle, it became clear to me that there was no thing that I could do that was more useful than start writing this book on the pharmaceutical industry, because I had the ability to come at it from several angles, like kind of like the economic angle, the alternative health angle from my own experience and things I'd learned writing in that. And I just ever since I've started, I just feel like I know what I'm doing. You know, I wake up in the morning with a sense of purpose, and I feel like my particular combination of skills are apt for this. So, yeah, and, you know, little bits and pieces surface in articles. If you download the ebook, 7pharmamyths.com, then you'll get on my mailing list, and the breadcrumbs will lead to where you can read more of my articles as they come out.
That's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for doing the research and for writing this. It's certainly, you know, I talk about health and wellness all the time, and I don't really talk too much about the pharmaceutical stuff. First of all, I couldn't be bothered to. I just know that, you know, there's certain things that, you know, Western medicine is good for. Chop off your leg. I'm not going to do homeopathy, right? I'm just going to go to the ER and get it, you know, it's sewed back on. But for chronic disease, for the things that we spend trillions of dollars a year, you know, a year on the, you know, diabetes, heart disease, cancer, you know, autoimmune, like all these things, we're really not getting any healthier. So I'm glad that there's at least someone who is willing, you know, to do the research and to be able to speak to these things. And so that's great. Thank you.
Yeah, and it's an interesting thing doing the research, because I'd come across something on page 157 of a book that was utterly shocking. And I'd be like, wait, what? And then I just basically took all those most shocking things and put them in the first chapter of my book. To kind of like shake people awake a little bit, and I thought, you know, it would be buried on page 238 that in 1999 the Center for Disease Control and Prevention told us that while the average lifespan of people in the USA have lengthened by 30 years since 1900, 25 years of this gain are attributable to advances in public health. rather than medicine. Now, everyone thinks, not everyone, but most people think we're living longer due to medicine. And because of that, they can sell new pharmaceutical drugs. They're riding on a myth. In 2000, Pediatrics released a very comprehensive study in which they explained the 90% decline in infectious diseases not attributable to antibiotics, as most people think, but improvements in sanitary conditions and nutrition rather than medical treatments, mostly the access to cleaner water. So if you don't actually know the truth, it will lead you to make poor decisions when it comes to health. And it will also lead the government to implementing poor policy decisions. Some of the stuff I cover in my ebook and my book, my forthcoming book, there's going to be an intermediate step where I release a expanded version of the ebook on paperback. I talk about, for example, there's been instances where the government has massively increased healthcare spending with no tangible benefits to the populations that were targeted by it. But, you know, there was a time where New Jersey was a swamp, and every summer mosquitoes would come over into New York and bite people, infecting them with malaria and other diseases, but just not rich people, because in the summer they just go somewhere cooler, right? And now here we are in the 2020s, and being poor is still hazardous to your health. People on low incomes get all sorts of diseases. They're more likely to die from chronic illnesses than people who are more affluent. So instead of what they did in New York to stop everyone from getting malaria wasn't put people on a bunch of pharmaceutical medications or increase healthcare spending. What they did was they drained the swamp, literally. They improved the conditions in New Jersey, and then it wasn't a swamp, and mosquitoes weren't flying over infecting people with malaria anymore. Similarly, when people don't actually understand that it's public health, access to better nutrition, water, refrigeration, clean sewers, not living in houses with mold and rising damp, or living 8-to-1 room, as used to be the case in our history, that people's health improve, you make the wrong policy decisions, you spend money in the wrong places, instead of saying, well, what would give us the maximum bang for our buck? How could we spend that money in such a way that would reduce the amount of disease? We run around chasing our tail trying to treat preventable illnesses. In fact, according to official sources, something like 70% of the diseases that people are afflicted with are due to lifestyle decisions. So you have these two things, public health and poor lifestyles, leading to ever-increasing healthcare costs. And that's what we're facing at the moment. And when people, you know, they say the truth will set you free, but first it will myth you, to put it nicely. You know, people should learn about these facts, and then it will set us free, because, you know, we're spending for the healthcare spending in the U.S. approaches $4 trillion. Singapore has a similar economy, the USA, and they spend a quarter per head on what the USA does in healthcare, and they live 6 years longer, and they're much, much healthier. They have a much better healthcare system, which was largely conceived of by American economists trying to fix America's healthcare system.
Interesting.
Yeah, that kind of stuff comes in, and so if America could save even half on healthcare, never mind three quarters, that would be enough to keep both conservatives and liberals happy, because you could use the money to balance the budget, to give people a tax cut, and you'd still have enough money left over to pay for Social Security out of the savings. So this really is a case where the truth would set us free.
It doesn't seem that there is accountability, and at least it looks like, you know, that there's a money trail. You know, when they talk about, you know, following the science, it's actually been really interesting over the last few years because people are coining that term, follow the science. And then if we question the science, you know, sometimes those of us that are questioning the science that is presented, especially when it doesn't make any sense or it's irrelevant to the question, then we're told we are being like, you know, Luddites and not scientific and things like that. So can you comment a little bit about, you know, this whole science thing?
Well, it's interesting that people say to trust the science because, you know, the editors of top journals say that you can't trust the science. And maybe I can just come to that, come to some quotes for you in a second on that point. So the editors of the New England Journal of Medicine and The Lancet both resigned in disgust, claiming that at least 70% of the articles in their journal were trash and biased towards the corporate healthcare industry bodies that funded their research. Richard Horton of The Lancet wrote, "Journals have developed into information laundering operations for the pharmaceutical industry." Richard Smith, who was the editor of the British Medical Journal for 25 years, said, "Major medical journals are just an extension of the marketing departments of major drug companies." Dr. Marcia Angel, editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, got into a lot of trouble with her colleagues when she said, "It is simply no longer possible to believe much of the clinical research that is published or to rely on the judgment of trusted physicians or authoritative medical guidelines. I take no pleasure in this conclusion, which I reached slowly and reluctantly over my two decades as an editor of the New England Journal of Medicine." And if you dig around, you'll find more stuff like this. Catherine DeAngelis, editor-in-chief of the Journal of the American Medical Association, said, "Don't believe anything, not one thing, put out by a pharmaceutical company. Just don't believe it." Drummond Rennie, the deputy editor, wrote, "There seems to be no study too fragmented, no hypothesis too trivial, no literature citation too biased or too egotistical, no design too warped, no mythology too bungled, no presentation of results too inaccurate, too obscure, and too contradictory, no analysis too self-serving, no argument too circular, no conclusions too trifling or too unjustified, and no grammar and syntax too offensive for a paper to end up in print." And I've got a whole bunch of quotes from the, or like these, from leading authorities. So they're telling us that you can't trust what's in the mainstream medical journals. But what I would always like to get at is why. Why are things like this? Because I can tell you, Dr. Karen, so many pharma scandals that I've come across, scandal after scandal, but the conclusion that people want to reach is, well, I'm sure this is the kind of thing that slips through the crack from time to time. Whereas what I would like to say is that the problem is systematic, and these are the results that the system is bound to arrive at for particular reasons. And if I could illustrate, would you like to come in first?
Yeah, just for a sec here, I want to interject around what you just said. Well, a couple of things. Number one is we did see, you know, some articles come out in very so-called prestigious journals, right? New England, Lancet, BMJ, like, and that really were so-called, you know, debunking some of the strategies that some of the holistic doctors or some of the doctors were speaking out, you know, in terms of, you know, whether that be hydroxychloroquine or masking or whatever, these different journals, you know, were create almost like creating out of thin air. Sometimes that was true, right? Some data that made it sound like whatever, you know, wow. You know, I had a friend, and this was before, I mean, I don't really, you know, watch the news. So I had a friend, I said something about ivermectin. Not that I prefer natural, you know, non-pharmaceuticals. But anyway, I said something about ivermectin. And he says to me, "You mean the horse paste?" And I'm like, "What?" I'm like, "I'm a medical doctor. I've prescribed it before." Like, you know, like, what is he talking about, right? And I didn't realize that it was this whole, like, media campaign against Joe Rogan, you know, in the U.S. and about him getting better with it. And so everyone started calling it horse paste. And I'm like, "Oh, my gosh, this is nuts. This is crazy." Yeah. And then, you know, just things being pulled, so they're published in a prestigious journal, then maybe there's some ethical, you know, scientists there to go, "Well, show us your raw data," and they can't.
Right.
No, so they then can. They pull it, but they don't publicize that they pull it, right? So then everyone's already believed it because it splashed all over the media.
Right, and they say that a lie travels halfway across the world before the truth has time to pull its pants up. So what they can do is they can use the media to insert memes, and people just repeat them uncritically. You know, obviously, Donald Trump was a master of this, creating memes for people and things like that, and then people would just go along. But it's not a new tactic. You know, you can create something that's an earworm, and then people will repeat it. So once you've got it in your head that ivermectin is horse-based, it doesn't matter that previously there was a whole bunch of studies advocating it for this, that, and the other, and people were using it for various things. You know, as
or
an
hydroxychloroquine, right? That in the study they used like multiple times the safe dose known. I prefer to not have to use pharmaceuticals. You know, why in this study, right? Unless you meant to do it that way, would you give toxic doses of a pharmaceutical that is not required to be in toxic doses to show that there's an effect in this case on COVID?
Right.
And then show, "Oh my gosh, there's heart irregularities."
Right. Yeah. And I mean, speaking of heart irregularities, the less said, the better. I mean, my own mother got arterial fibrillations from her second COVID shot, and she has to live with that now. No one compensated her, neither the government nor the manufacturer.
Well, they said they can't prove it, right? Drug. Oh, she's old.
Yeah. Well, I mean. They admitted that it was the vaccine that caused the injury.
Oh, really? Okay. Not in Canada.
Well, she wasn't compensated for it, of course.
Wow. So, well, and that's really difficult to get compensation for something like that. Mm-hmm. My mom ended up with her after her second shot, and the funny thing is, in her first shot, she for whatever reason felt a love for Pfizer. So anyway, so she got her first shot, but she had said to me before the first shot, she says, "I think this shot's going to kill me." I said, "Well, then don't take it." I said, "Why do you think it's going to kill you?" "Well, because I have so many allergies and, you know, blah, blah, blah." I'm like, "Yeah, that's true. You know, you would be high risk for autoimmune, and because you're already allergic to, or you were allergic to so many things." I'm thinking of the PEG, you know, in the shot and what could happen. But she was asymptomatic after the first shot. Now, mind you, did I do some work on her? Yes, I did. Okay, energetic. But the second one, I actually didn't really know about. Like, I didn't really get a heads up on that because I don't think they knew what I thought about it, so they didn't tell me. And I didn't get a wind of it till much later. And then she calls me in the middle of the night, which I did not pick up till the next day. She's in the hospital. She needs a pacemaker. Now, previously, she'd always said, anxious, and I think my heart, but every time they test her, she was completely fine. So the woman's got so many EKGs, and they couldn't find anything wrong with her, but this time it was real, right? Heart rate of 30 is not good. And I'm, you know, from afar just going, "Hey, do you have your LifeWay patches? I'll tell you where to patch your acupuncture points," you know. And she's like, "No, I didn't think of bringing them, and, you know, Dad's not allowed to come to the hospital anymore," and all that kind of stuff. So she was alone doing that thing, and she said to me, "I think it's the shot."
Yeah.
So I said, well, I said, you're safe. You're getting a pacemaker at this point, seriously, you know? Mm. And yeah. That's what she did. So now she has to live with that.
Right. And, you know, that's the consequences of people's actions. I wouldn't mind so much if we weren't forced to pay for it at gunpoint through the tax system. I mean, if people want to take these treatments, they should pay for them out of their own pocket. And they might think twice. I work with and learn from mainstream doctors who are in the system, and so that I can, they help me get the language, you know, the language right, and mm-hmm. they tell me about stuff that's going on. And I've got one friend, he, for purely
epidemiological, I know, epidemiological.
Yeah, he was skeptical about the jab from the beginning because he just looked at what they were saying and went, yeah, maybe they should just like safety test these for longer and gather their data properly, because this is not the way I was trained that medical science should be done. Told his old family that they shouldn't get the shot. Of course, almost everyone did get at least one and two. And they got injured left and right for it. His cousins are like, what can we do? He's like, I don't know. There's nothing you can do. I told you not to get it. You know, one of his friends had a seizure, first shot, went back, and guess what? Went back for another one, and she got a seizure again. You know, sometimes you just can't tell people anything. And then he's getting a slew of patients coming in with irregularities in their menstrual cycle. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the other doctors say, oh, it's definitely not the vaccine. It's definitely not the vaccine. How do they know that it's not the vaccine? I mean, imagine being so ignorant as to say something as a doctor, as a someone that people consider to be an authority, just not based on any science, just because it's what you personally prefer to believe.
Right. It's called BS, belief system. Yeah. As Dr. Bruce Lipton would say, he's like, it's BS, belief system.
right. That's what you prefer to believe, and that's what it's nice and safe for you to believe. But it's definitely not science.
Mm-mm. Yeah, well, I actually, Anthony, I had a nurse practitioner friend of mine. She's now retired, but, you know, I said, hey, you know, the Canadian COVID Care Alliance made this really nice video just kind of breaking down, you know, the studies and stuff, the Pfizer study and things like that. I think it's, you know, a good watch to do, and I'm quite concerned. But I kind of tried to use my words wisely. So I'm very concerned, you know, about this and the data, and especially with children, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so she wrote back. She goes, don't ever email me again about this. I work for a very high-profile immunologist here, and I cannot believe, like, what happened to that very smart medical doctor I knew years ago who worked for UCLA, and, like, have you lost your marbles? And I was like,
wow.
What?
There's an open mind for you.
And I was like, I can email her about everything else but that, right? And I was like, oh my gosh, the brainwashing is like so in-depth. And here's the thing, Anthony, now you probably not privy to this, but I get emails from New York State Office of the Professions. They email hospitals, doctors, nurses, you know, that it's part of the thing. It's annoying, actually, because I there's no opt-out button, so I have to get these emails, even though I'm retired. So I have to get these emails about, you know, influenza surveillance report and blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay, well, at least they're still doing that. And I normally ignore these, but I did open a couple of them during the, you know, in the middle of the pandemic, the height of the pandemic. And it literally had, like, special webinar with doctors about, you know, how to handle, you know, the pandemic and blah, blah, blah. And some of the stuff that they were, you know, just summarizing on the advertisement, I was like, oh, I can see why doctors, you know, like literally it said, Anthony, evidence-based, blah, 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 right? So doctors don't have time to go through the raw data. We just don't.
Right.
So we rely on our state, you know, the state, we rely on our American, you know, Family Medicine Association, whatever, right? Like whatever country we're in, to kind of summarize it for us. So whatever they say, we're like, well, they must have done the work, right? They must have done due diligence instead of us doing it, because we don't have time to do it. And I can totally see why my colleagues, you know, felt the way they did, because they're like, I was on this webinar last week, right, about COVID, and they were fed whatever they were fed, and it sounded convincing, you know. Then when we go down that rabbit hole, like you and I have, and you start going, wait a second. Immunology. Okay, so wait a second. There was never a placebo in any vaccine trial? Really? Ever?
Right. Yeah. People don't believe
like
that.
Not like there's nothing like vaccine versus saline.
Right.
No. And I just went, I had no idea.
Yeah, and they managed to keep this a secret even from doctors. Here's the thing when it comes to vaccine hesitancy. The CDC could really put everyone's mind to rest very, very easily. There's approximately 800,000 Americans that have never had a single shot. Now, what they could do is they could just do a big study where they take 10, 25, 50,000, 100,000 of these 800,000 people at random and just chart what chronic illnesses they have and then compare them to vaccinated populations. And, you know, if what we're told about vaccines is true, these 800,000 people should be swamps of disease, right? They should have all sorts of communicable diseases and complaints that vaccinated populations don't have. It would be very easy to do the study, and you could say once and for all, look how unhealthy these 800,000 people who have never been vaccinated are. I think that the CDC will never do the study. In fact, Tony Fauci told Dale Bigtree, who made the Vax documentary, we are never going to do that study. Congress has ordered the CDC to do the study, and the CDC has never done a study.
Wow, they ordered them. I did not know they ordered them.
They have been ordered to do it in the 80s. And a bill's come before Congress to order them to do it several more times since then, but it usually gets shot down before even going to a vote. So they've never done the study. It would be an easy study to do. Alas, when people have done the study, one person, Anthony Mawson, there's an Anthony Mawson study, and another one, Paul Thomas and James Lyons Wheeler, in recent years have done such studies, and you would believe that the more vaccines you have, the more prone you are to develop chronic diseases and a whole host of other health complaints. Now, it could be that those studies were poorly conducted. Who am I to say? What I would say is, if that is the case, then I would like to challenge the CDC to do a better design study and let's see what are the long-term health outcomes of vaccinated and unvaccinated populations. You know, put our minds to rest, show all those crazy anti-vaxxers that they're barking up the wrong tree. It would be
That's true. That would be a relatively easy study compared to everything else. And speaking of studies, you know, I was asking, you know, some of my doctor friends who's willing to tell me, you know, what was the follow-up? You know, because I said, well, you guys are enrolled in a humongous experiment. So what kind of follow-up is that? Because when I did a very small study here in town, we had to get an IRB, and then it was very strict, like, you know, following up. And then if somebody, you know, we couldn't contact them, we had to prove that we tried to contact them multiple times to find out what went on. Did they have side effects? You know, all that kind of stuff, right? And I'm like, wow, this is a huge study. And so in this Canadian COVID Care Alliance video, they talked about how after a very short period of time, they decided to give the placebo people the real thing. And I'm like, wait a second. You can't do that. You can't do that in, first of all, there's risks, right? But it's like, it's a placebo-controlled trial. So if there's no placebo, you won't be able to actually compare. And you only, what was it, 2 months or something? I mean, I talked to some of my friends, you know, that did get it. And you know, some said, they followed up. There's an app, you know, and then you fill out the app, right? And then other people complain. I'm like, well, whatever symptom they said was on there, like headaches or arm, whatever. Yeah, but that wasn't my symptom.
Right.
So if I had like anaphylaxis or I was near death or if you know, I had, you know, autoimmune, that wasn't listed. So I couldn't even put it down. There was no place to put it down, even if they did follow up.
Right. And there's so many reasons why the underreporting of injuries from this vaccine is so profound. One is the first thing that doctors will do is deny that it was the vaccine that caused the injury. Most mainstream doctors will, then the whole process of reporting is hard and unreliable. People themselves, I know people, when I was back in Scotland, I was living with someone who went into a seizure from taking one of her COVID shots, and she, neither her nor her doctor reported that as a vaccine injury, and this was prevalent. Even though when I was in school, I was tested for a shot and came up with allergic reactions, so they didn't give it to me. I was out in Mexico, and my mother was on the phone trying to find out how I could get an exemption, and no one knew. No one knew. She had to speak to so many people, and eventually she spoke to someone who said, oh, well, you can't really get an exemption unless you've had a reaction to this shot. And it's like, it's a little bit late by that point, don't you think?
Well, yeah, like, you know, and here, in, you know, religious exemptions has been interesting because, you know, people are like, well, you know, there's some of the cell lines they use, you know, are aborted fetal cells and yada, yada, right? So I'm Christian or I'm this or that, and we don't want that. But there's more Christian, you know, I hate to say it, but there's just more religious Christian people who either don't know or don't care. Right, they're so scared,
right?
That and then of course the Pope, or not the Pope, but you know, bishops or whatever, are like, it's okay for the highest good, you know, it's okay. There's aborted fetal cells, but it's okay, you know. God says it's okay. Oh my goodness. Well, Anthony, before we get to doing some more, you know, myths and misconceptions, and you know how to discern the signs we see it online and taking back our health, I wanted to share with you an email that I got on the 24th of February, and we are recording this on the 26th, so that was 2 days ago. Okay, this is from New York State, and this is from those that, you know, give us those surveillance reports and everything like that. It says, and I quote, effective January 1st, 2023, the New York State Department of Health implemented a revised surveillance case definition for multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children, so MISC, associated with coronavirus disease 2019 infection or vaccination. I went, what? Suspected and confirmed cases of MISC in persons less than 21 years of age potentially associated with COVID-19 infection or COVID-19 vaccination are required to be reported. And when I'm looking at the PDF, it says reporting. Okay, hospitals are required to report suspected confirmed cases of MISC potentially associated with SARS-CoV-2 infection or COVID-19 vaccination, those under 21 years of age, to the New York State Department of Health. Cases of MISC are reported using the Health Electronic Response Data System, HERDS, application. And it says these cases need to be reported to the Vaccine Adverse Event Reporting System, VAERS, in accordance with federal requirement. I just about fell over in my chair. This is mainstream medicine telling their doctors and nurses and hospitals they need to report this. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, it certainly shows that something new is coming in.
Mm-hmm. Like an acknowledgement of potentially there's a thing? You know? Yeah, that was shocking. I was not expecting that from mainstream at all.
Yes, and as I say, like, I've got some doctors who are in the mainstream position, and one of my friends in Delaware has spoken to me about, like, certain shifts. Even herself, she told, so, you know, she looked crazy telling her staff some of these things early on, and she said, everyone thought she was crazy, because she's actually, everyone in her practice knows she herself was vaccine injured. One of her nurses came in and said, oh, I got the flu and blah, blah. And she said, did you know that paper came out earlier on that said getting the flu shot predisposed you to getting COVID? I'm sorry, I don't like to quote these things when I can't tell you the paper, but just for the sake of brevity. And her nurse was like, you know, Dr. Mavrikakis, are you kidding? And she was like, no. And no, don't you believe me? And she's like, no. It's like, even in her own practice, she'd seen this shift in mentality, and where it was really dangerous for her to report things at first, she's noticed that there has been a little bit of a shift. where she could actually report vaccine injuries.
Okay, and not be fired? Or not taking her life away or anything?
She is definitely taking her, you know, she is definitely taking her. I wouldn't say her name, but she told me that she's out now and she's done some podcasts and things like that. So she's definitely put herself, put her head above the parapet. So more power to her.
Yeah, especially if you're practicing now, like in the regular system, that is very difficult. It's interesting because when I tuned into, you know, my guide, if you will, or guidance, when would be a good time to go all online? And because I only had 20 patients anyway, you know, but I was spending a lot of time with them, and I love them, and they didn't, you know, I was spending a lot of money just keeping an office going just for those 20 patients. And so Sora said to close shop May of 2019, and I had actually told them, you know, year and a half, 2 years, I'll be done. Well, a year and a half was May. 2 years was November, and I thought, well, you know, I'll just do November, because they were so upset at the possibility of not being able to see me, right? And then I got a hint from the universe. I won't go into that story. May it is. May it is. So I closed up shop in May. Now I had no idea this was coming down, and now I know why I got that guidance, you know, to close up shop in May, because that would, I mean, so I could do, honestly, so I could do my mission, you know, because otherwise it would have been a pain in the butt to try to juggle all of that and the pandemic and everything like that. So I'm very fortunate that I followed that guidance.
Yeah. So you mentioned something really important, which is evidence-based medicine. And whenever you hear, you at home here, I'm just going to give you, this is good. You can spread this around, okay? Whenever you hear evidence-based medicine, what you should really hear is authority-based medicine. And I'm going to explain why. Mm. In the old days, when doctors were trained with the biomedical model, which is interesting because I actually disagree with the biomedical model. However, what they were trained to do was, to some degree, be scientists, you know, read studies, and rely on their wits to come to conclusions on what treatments to perform. As you moved to the evidence-based model, the idea is you do what the evidence says, and that means basically what the authorities tell you the evidence says. Mm. So you have something like the American Diabetes Association making recommendations on insulin and treatments for diabetes, or something like the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association making recommendations on what to do, who to give statins to, for example, or the American Cancer Association, and all of these bodies form one point where the drug companies in that industry can basically bribe and colonize. They fill the boards of these organizations with former employees or scientists who are open to being influenced or to accepting funds. You know, oh, don't worry, you know, we're going to take you and the wife away for a long weekend, and we're going to put on a continuing medical education conference and tell you. And then what happens is the guidelines for the number of people who should be taking statins goes down ever so slightly, and more people are on statins. Then maybe if you're 60 or over, you should take statins. No, let's make it 58. No, let's make it 57. Okay, and you've got just, you know, slightly high cholesterol, maybe you should be in a statin as well. And they use these bodies who are meant to be providing people with, providing doctors with authoritative, objective, evidence-based guidelines on what to prescribe for what, and that soon becomes the standard of care. And now, as a doctor, you can be fired for not giving a statin to a 57-year-old, even though there's no real evidence that statins are actually effective for primary prevention of a heart attack. There is some evidence that for some people, mostly males, if you've had an heart attack already, then taking a statin may help prevent you from having a second one. But there's very little evidence to suggest that that statins are good for primary prevention of a heart attack, or will increase or decrease your overall mortality. In other words, even if you don't die of a heart attack or a stroke, you might just die of cancer instead, or you might die of something else at just about the same age as you would have had you not taken the statin, plus now you've got all of the negative side effects and the lowering of the quality of life that you have to admit for being on that drug and what they call preventative medicine. So evidence-based medicine sounds like a good idea. If I was going to put a chemical into my body that was going to have a profound effect on my biochemistry, I definitely want to know that it was based on some good, solid scientific evidence. Unfortunately, that's simply not the case under the current based system, because evidence-based medicine is just what these authorities cherry-pick as the studies that they choose to rely on, most of which, in fact, probably all of which, are conducted by drug companies, because the FDA doesn't conduct a single study. Drug companies submit their studies to the FDA. They could run 10 studies, for all you know, and bury 8 of them, and just cherry-pick the 2 with the most favorable results. The regulator doesn't have to show the data to the public. Not only that, but the drug company doesn't have to show all the data to the regulator. The journals,
right.
The journals could insist that drug companies submitted all of the raw data to them before publishing their studies, but they don't. And one of the reasons journals, first of all, they sell advertising space to drug companies, and secondly, they can sell reprints of articles that are favorable to
pharmaceutical companies.
They can sell a
reprint. Kinda.
Yeah.
You a reprint order. Study, yeah, looks good. We'll buy some more from you.
Yeah.
Reprints, give to our doctors.
That's right. So the drug company buys tens of thousands of copies of journal articles, and then they post them out to doctors to propagandize those doctors into prescribing those drugs. So they're all on one side, and it's not yours.
Okay. Now, we talked about, you know, evidence-based medicine may not be really evidence-based, maybe more authoritarian-based. What about when I was in school, they created something called the Cochrane Database.
Mm-hmm.
So they're supposed to take all the data, tell us they throw out studies that are bad, you know, that are really poorly done. They keep the ones that are really good. Then they kind of do an overall conclusion, and they're called meta-analyses.
That's right.
For those of you that listening that aren't familiar with this. So are they bought and paid for as well?
Well, in the Cochrane... The Cochrane collaboration is about the best we've got, although one of their great researchers, Peter Goschke, I don't know how to pronounce his name, who wrote some very amazing books on exposing fraud in the psychiatric industry, was actually thrown out for being too radical, even though I think his claims were based on very good reading of the evidence. But yeah, the Cochrane Collaboration do really good meta-analyses. There's other organizations that attempt to do this, and I think they're the most prominent. Even so, there is a massive problem with simply not registering studies that are not favorable. And
If
no one knows that the study even was conducted, no one can include it into a meta-analysis.
Oh.
However, meta-analyses are the best we have, and they are expensive to do. And not everything that works in healthcare really can very easily conform to like a double-blind study. I mean,
right.
Things, but because these studies are very much about how certain chemicals affect certain pathways, even in nutritional science, how this nutrient works on this. And we know from nutritional science that actually Nutrients work in concert together, and Whole Foods, the nature's not stupid. It packages different chemicals together, so it's very hard to do this reductionist science for everything that might be healthful for us. Certainly, when it comes to repressing symptoms, if that's what you want, if you want symptom control, the kind of scientific method that we understand can work pretty well for that, as long as we're actually getting all the data. There's a book called Bad Pharma, but I think his name's Ben Goldacre. He has maybe 100 pages dedicated to explaining all the ways where our actual data is missing. And until the authorities decide that every single paper, every single study that is conducted needs to be registered and logged in a database, a lot of the time what they'll do is they'll just stop studies early if there's too many side effects or if the drug isn't looking effective enough. They just stop the study early and then they go, well, you know, that study's not really very good data because it was, you know, it was stopped early. But it stopped early, you know, they've got motivations for stopping them early.
Right. Like, yeah. is that like for example, remdesivir or some of the Canadian frontline nurses call run, death is near?
Right. Yeah, I know. I've heard bad things about remdesivir. I can't really tell you the specific details of that particular pharma scandal, but it's definitely, it looks like it's a dangerous drug. And to be honest, most drugs are dangerous. I wouldn't take them unless you absolutely had to. A lot of the times they will say that this or that drug lowers your chance of dying from a particular condition. But unless they tell you that all-cause mortality was reduced, it probably wasn't, because they're always going to frame the data in the most beneficial light for themselves.
Well, I believe that happened with some of the studies that was commissioned to track autism and related to vaccines. And of course, the conclusions always, you know, no, it's nothing to do with it. Like, it's, if you just look at the summary articles, they're like, oh yeah, it's fine, right? But then if you actually interviewed the parents, they're like, my child was fine, and then, you know, this thing happened. And then one of the movies, I think it's called For the Greater Good, you know, talks about how there was a whistleblower, you know, that basically said that they had to keep redoing the data, the charts. They changed the parameters so much so that it didn't look like there was a trend between, you know, black babies, you know, African-American babies and Caucasian white
and
babies.
I think they say there's no evidence. But let me see if I can find this. I did actually come across a site that catalogued about 30-something studies that did link vaccines to autism. You see, one of the things that happens is if you sue a company, a drug company, or the drugs industry, here we go, sorry. This happened with breast implants. Health Impact News, 30 scientific studies showing the link between vaccines and autism by Lisa Joyce Goes, if anyone wants to look it up. So what happened with breast implants is there was a lawyer tried to bring forth a class action lawsuit and was advised that there wasn't enough evidence to justify suing the industry for just general damage from implants that hadn't leaked. But he wanted to go ahead, and as a consequence of that, he actually lost the case. So it was about like 10, 20 years before the industry could be sued again for that reason. And in the meantime, the only way that a woman could claim compensation is if she could argue that her implant had leaked. If it hadn't leaked, the court would have to conclude that it wasn't because of the implant that she received whatever damage. Now, Something similar happened with vaccines and autism, where someone was told that, you know, don't do it, just hold on tight because we're still gathering the evidence and you're going to screw it up again. You're going to screw it up for everyone who's had a child with autism caused by a vaccine. But of course he went ahead and tried to sue and as a consequence failed the case, and we're still waiting before that can be done again, and if the evidence has been collected correctly. And with these vaccine courts, they have a problem where you cannot use other cases as a precedent and say, well, you know, this child,
interesting,
the whole vaccine court thing is like such an obvious attempt to shield cronies from being sued for damages caused by vaccines. Like in any other case, you can say, well, there's a precedent because this product caused this particular harm before. But when you go to these vaccine courts in the USA, every particular instance is taken as though it's in a vacuum without, you know, parents being able to refer to previous cases. So it's pretty shocking.
That is crazy, because isn't normally there's a precedent in legal matters, right, that you look at the legal precedent from previously help you make decisions. But you're saying in this case, when it comes to...
No, that's why they created a whole new court for it,
so that
you could avoid, you know... It's like, what kind of system do you think you live in? It's like, people are so...
Wow.
It's like, but the thing is, what we're dealing with is like your friend who said, never email me about this again. Like, that is... And it would be okay if people were just suffering the consequences of their own actions, but it's the kids. People are... The kids are suffering the consequences of their parents' choice to remain willfully ignorant in the face of, you know, I don't know how to make sense of the suffering that's been caused by all these things, because on one hand I can say when it comes to these COVID shots, if you're an adult, you know, you're responsible, you probably had some crazy relative who said, look at this or look at that, and you chose to be willfully ignorant. But now they're putting these mRNA vaccines on the childhood vaccine schedule, and kids are being dosed up. And if they get injured, you know, what choice did they have? So, you know, I don't know.
Because I think in the U.S., the way the law works is that if it's on the childhood vaccination schedule, then the pharmaceutical companies are exempt from any liability at all, which is why the push was so hard and fast to get it on that schedule.
And if it's shocking to me that people tolerate this, you know, that people tolerate the fact that you can cause harms with vaccines and not be sued for it. I mean, what's in it for them? What's in it for them to not be able to sue, or for their neighbors not being able to sue a pharmaceutical company? You know, it's like, it's shocking. And it's the it's the people's nascence, not their ignorance. Nascence, they're ignoring the truth. They're not interested in the truth, because with the truth becomes a responsibility to do something about the truth. I guess, and it's a little bit upsetting, but, you know, how does the serenity prayer go, you know?
Right.
Lord, give me the courage to change the things I can change, the presence of mind to accept the things I can't change, and the wisdom to know the difference. And unfortunately, we need to accept that a lot of people are suffering unnecessarily, sometimes, you know, ourselves included, because we can't unvaccinate ourselves, and you don't really know what state of health you'd be in if you hadn't got whatever shots that you have had.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there's, you know, it seems to me that that there's, you know, I'm going to be honest, when I went through medical school and was looking at some of the journals, and they talked about diet, nutrition, or whatever, I was like, yeah, whatever. And then I'd be like, ooh, what's this drug? You know,
right.
ooh, science. You know, I was really a big science nerd, and I thought, you know, evidence-based medicine was like the best, and, you know, not realizing that there's a whole, you know, propagandized, you know, energy behind that. And so I wasn't all that interested in boring, nutrition. Yeah, how hard could it be to eat well, like seriously, right? Of course, I wasn't eating as well as I could be because I didn't know anything, you know, and I didn't like my biochemistry teacher who was also the nutrition teacher. So I didn't really pay attention. So but if we're talking... So Anthony, if we're talking about like discerning science we see online, this is going to be really difficult for the average person.
It is.
So do you have any hints on how we would do that?
Well, okay. First of all, I just have to say I have some sympathy for the doctors because really you should be able to trust authorities. We should have authorities that are trustworthy. Under the current system, there are no checks and balances because, as we saw with Vioxx scandal, the New England Journal of Medicine printed false claims that made Vioxx look safer than it was, and they were informed that they'd done that, and they refused to withdraw that article. Meanwhile, they sold almost $1 million of reprints of that article back to the manufacturer. When Dr. Graham at the FDA... tried to bring his findings on Vioxx to the medical community. He was first told to shut up and then offered promotion. So, first of all, I think it's important to realize that you're on your own when it comes to checks and balances, when it comes to drugs. The journals, the universities, the regulator, are all profiting from the sale of pharmaceutical drugs. So the first thing is, before you take a drug, make sure that you absolutely have to. Take the side effects seriously and maybe ask your doctor, what are the likely side effects of this? And see if you can even ask them, what percentage of people tend to get these side effects? See if they can give you a figure or not. See if you can find, like, all-cause mortality is important. Find out if the drug not is going to save you from dying from the condition it's meant to treat, but all causes, because it's not really much use to you if you die at the same age, but you die of nephritis because the drug poisons your liver.
That's a good tip. Finding all-cause mortality, especially for a drug that you're taking every single day. And, for long periods of time.
And, so the question is, will this extend my life? How long will it extend my life for? And in what way might it compromise my quality of life? Failing that, along with that, nothing's going to get better for you if you're eating lots of junk food, period. So, you know, what you want is whole foods from as natural sources as you can get, get them from. Your tissues are made up of, your body makes your tissues out of vitamins, minerals, amino acids, oxygen, water, and what have you. So you can't make healthy tissues out of drugs because there's no such thing as a Tylenol deficiency. If you're depressed, you don't have a Prozac deficiency.
Right.
So I say, like, start by looking at your body as a biological organism that has needs and ask, what does my body need to build healthy tissues? In addition to that, what do I need to spare my body from? Because everything that you put in that your body can't make use of needs to leave the body via one of your detoxification organs. And you can put too much strain on those organs and damage them if you're putting poisons into your body. So I would like to start with that. And I've got some more tips in my ebook, which you can find at 7pharmamyths.com.
Oh, that's great. And speaking of, you just mentioned the word poison. I saw a news. It's one of those on one of those other channels where they just take a clip of it about what they were saying, And it was around, well, there's a couple of them, but it was around how unvaccinated people have more car accidents, I think that was.
Wow.
Something like that. And then, you know, somebody else saying, well, yeah, you know, yeah, yeah. They're kind of admitting that there could be, you know, potential side effects. But the guy that was being interviewed, he says, well, you know, you got to pick your poison, right? And I just sort of was like, wow, that's actually true. I mean, in this context. And then in Australia, I have friends in Australia, and somebody screenshotted the Australian government's, you know, description of the COVID-19 vaccination. You can look that up, too. I don't think they've changed it. And it literally actually says a poison. And so I said to my Australian friends, I'm like, wait a second. This is back in 2021 or something. Anyway, it was like way back, and I said, it says the word poison. Like, does poison mean something different in, like, Australian speak? Because sometimes your words are different from ours versus, like, America. And my naturopathic, you know, healthcare friends were like, nope, it means exactly what it means, like, in America. I'm like, and your government calls it that? And they're like, yep.
Well, all drugs need to be poisons, because if they're not poisons, they're not considered drugs. So it needs to be cytotoxic. Any drug needs to be... otherwise, it's something else. Do you know what I mean? It's a nutrient or something. If it's affecting you, so one of the qualities of a drug is that it is a poison.
Well, I thought it was interesting that for a while I was excited to hear. Don't quote me on this one, but I think it was. You know, when I got wind of, this is when I was still practicing medicine, regular medicine, I got wind of that one of the statin companies that made statins was actually had a patent on coenzyme Q10 attached to the drug. And I was very innocent and naive, and I thought, well, that's great. They figured it out. You know, I mean, if you're going to give a statin, you might as well give coenzyme Q10 or Ubiquinol will be better. But I was all excited, and I'm waiting, and I'm waiting. And I'm like, well, when's this drug gonna be released, right? I mean, I'll prescribe that one if I have to prescribe something versus Prevastatin, right? If you give me, you know, or versus some other statin. Well, it didn't come. And then I was on this webinar with Suzanne Summers, who's kind of a natural health advocate, and she says, oh yeah, they patent things like that, so no one else can release it, and they just keep it. They don't ever sell it. So that's when I started.
They do that. They can bury things. Yeah.
Yeah, that's when I started going. Wait a second. If they know that the statin causes problems, and then by giving coenzyme Q10, it at least partially reverses that issue, why wouldn't you want to sell that drug and be the top of the market? Because no one else has got that patented, right? So there's an intention to not help people.
Right, and there's things like, you know, DMSO that's got like lots of applications, and is obviously a repressed remedy because of that. People used to, this is not medical advice, but you know, turpentine used to be used, castor oil still sometimes people use it to purge. But I mean, there's lots of remedies that were widely used and widely known to be useful, but they're a little bit too useful. You know, some in Chinese medicine, they would always look at we're looking at one remedy for one condition, whereas they'd be looking for like a plant like ginseng, which has multiple benefits for multiple conditions, because they want to help you with lots of things at once. So it's kind of like a whole back to front mentality we live in. People think that we have a filtration system where the best remedies are going to rise to the top. The truth is, as far as the industry is concerned, the best remedy is the newest one that's on patent. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if an older remedy has a better safety profile, because you know they can't get a market monopoly on an older remedy. So it doesn't matter if it has fewer side effects or is more effective. What they really want is the new one. And sometimes they don't even develop new drugs. What they'll do is they'll change the coating on a pill and get a new patent for that or something like that.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's called evergreening. They've got lots and lots of different ways of repatenting drugs that aren't new.
Run out of the patent, then they can't make money on it because other people can generically make it, right?
Yeah, they can generically make it. So the thing to do is to combine it with, you know, add an extra hydrogen atom or something like that, just slightly change it and see if they can patent it again, and then start telling people, no, this was the new one. It's so much better than the old one. Even OxyContin, which, created this opiate epidemic, it was like 10 times more addictive than a previous chemical that they were using, but that painkiller was out of patent. So OxyContin became the new thing that they were trying to promote, not because it was provided better pain relief or anything like that, just because they got a new patent on it.
Yes.
And that caused untold amount of suffering.
Yes. Well, there's a couple questions about, you know, myths and things I want to ask you. Number one is I heard that in order, at least in America, for the drug companies to get a stamp of approval by the FDA, they have to submit 2 positive studies, mm-hmm. meaning that their mm-hmm. drug works. Even if there are like 80 studies that say they don't work, they don't have to submit it like you mentioned. Is it actually just 2?
I believe that's still the case. I don't know really the ins and outs of the regulatory process. What I do know is that it used to take something like 4 years to get a drug passed. Now it's something like 14 years. So that whole process, say if the drugs that we had were much safer because now they take an extra 10 years to go through the regulatory process, then we'd want that maybe. But because it's a cost-benefit analysis, but actually they're not any safer, and just as more drugs are withdrawn now than before then. What this does is it creates a huge, humongous expense for drug companies, which is good and bad for them, because it certainly alienates any competition. I mean, if you wanted to do a study proving that stem cells might be helpful for stopping people from needing a hip or shoulder replacement or from getting arthritis, you would need to do one study for each condition and take each condition through the whole regulatory process, which is going to run into hundreds of millions. So it means that their existing treatments are safe from competition.
They kind of grandfathered in, and then so that's why a lot of companies that have natural remedies and things like that, they don't go through the FDA process because compete, you know, with the pharmaceuticals. Yeah. So they don't have those kind of deep pockets or that kind of time.
They don't have those kinds of deep pockets. And once their remedies are approved, they're not under patent or anything like that. They don't have protections if they're made of natural ingredients. So anyone can manufacture them. Until we get a system that profits from people improving their health instead of profits from getting them sicker, no one will have the pockets to fund research into these remedies and take them through the regulatory process. Now, what it also does is, because it takes so long and it costs so much money, it creates an incredible incentive for fraud to be committed with the data, because you don't want to waste 800 million or whatever taking a drug through this regulatory system just to have it rejected. And it also discourages innovation, because why try a new chemical when the safest thing to do is just like slightly alter an existing chemical, because you know what it's going to do, and then you might not need to run all the same host of safety studies either if you say, well, this is just basically like our other chemical which has been approved.
That's right. That's kind of like what they were doing with the I think they call it Comirnaty or whatever, which is the COVID-19 Pfizer, the new name. So
right.
Dr. Brzezinski here is from Texas, and he has been helping people with very intense brain cancers and other kind of things, and his anti-neoplastin therapies have been really, really useful and helpful and saved a lot of people's lives. These children, for example, were supposed to die, and they're like adults now. And he's been trying since the 70s to go through the FDA process for his anti-neoplastins, and to this day, they are still not approved, despite all the studies.
Yeah, Yeah, and a lot of people end up having to go to Tijuana, Mexico, or something like that to get treatments that are verified, but just can't get through the approval process and are essentially illegal in the USA.
And then, do you have an idea how many, like how long a drug study has to go on before it's considered like
I don't know the ins and outs of that. But the thing is, just because something is approved doesn't mean safe, and just because it's not been approved doesn't mean it's unsafe. Just because it's approved doesn't mean it's effective, and just because it's not been approved doesn't mean that it's ineffective.
Gotcha.
So,
well, it seemed to me like there were some of these medications that, the studies were like 2 months, 3 months, that kind of thing, and then but we're using it for decades.
Yeah.
You know, on a person. I don't
right.
have long term
right.
studies
and,
on
and sometimes,
stomach and the proton and
yeah,
pump inhibitors
and sometimes doctors will prescribe them off label, which for demographics that they were in studied for. You know, they'll give them to kids or they'll give them to old people. The study sample was conducted on young healthy people, right? They selected
right.
young healthy people
right.
because that way they'd have the minimum amount of side effects. But then when you start giving those drugs to other demographics, it doesn't work so well. One of the reasons why hormone replacement therapy, which turned out to be butchery for women, actually killed so many women unnecessarily, was because they just had a population study that happened to be conducted on young, healthy women from affluent backgrounds who were well educated, and wow, it looks like it's really good and it's not got that many side effects. No, but they were actually just living longer because of their lifestyles. When they actually applied the study to real people and started giving them hormone replacement therapy, it caused a whole host of deaths and health problems. But you know, no one went to jail. No one ever goes to jail. They basically factor in being sued. Drug companies factor in being sued as an expense. I've got so many instances of drug companies being sued for their drugs causing harm, but the amount that they got fined or had to pay out in compensation after being taken to court was far lower than the profit they made from the drugs. So it's not really that much of a punishment. It's really just, paying off the feds,
So right, right. Well, let us sell this for as long as possible, and then you'll get your cut.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm being cynical.
That's right.
You may not know the answer to this one either, Anthony, and we do need to close pretty soon. Mm-hmm. This has been a very interesting conversation. But I was just wondering, some folks are kind of concerned or worried about having some sort of, patented substance in their bodies being injected mm-hmm. in that changed their DNA. Does that now mean that they, as a person, are patented by a drug company? It seems almost ridiculous to even consider that, but is that actually a concern, or is that just like a wise
guess? I've not heard anything about that. I find it hard to believe that would be upheld in court, but then I find so much of what's happened in the last 3 years hard to believe. People are saying, can you detox from this? Can you recover from this? The truth is, I don't know. I mean, I believe that the body's pretty resilient, and detox protocols have certainly helped me with a lot of things. But everyone really needs to do the best they can with what they've got, because even if you're living a pretty clean life, we're still getting toxins in through the environment, and, your thing could be... whatever you eat could have been sprayed with glyphosate and things. So we're trying our best. I don't know if you've taken this injection, if a company now holds a patent on you. It sounds like a sci-fi movie, but then so much of what happens now does sound like a sci-fi movie. I would stay away from medical interventions unless you absolutely have to. My teacher said, you cannot poison yourself to death. The human body is not meant to have anything in it that it's not made of. When you put in a compound that's made of hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, it recognizes these things. It knows how to metabolize them. When you start having chemicals that have got long names that are complete, that of chemicals that are not found in nature, that we did not evolve side by side with. Mm-hmm. You know, your detoxification organs, the livers, the kidney, the skin, the digestive tract has a little bit harder time recognizing these things and finding something to do with them. So they can bioaccumulate in the tissues and they can be harder to remove. So I'd say if it grows, eat it. If it doesn't grow, don't eat it, or rub it in your skin or into your hair. It's going to be absorbed through those membranes into your body. So all natural ingredients if you possibly can.
Yeah, that sounds great. Great advice. So thank you, Anthony, so much for being on the show, and I really appreciate the work that you're doing. And everyone can get the free ebook, 7pharmamyths.com. 7 is the number written out, not written out, sorry, the number 7pharmamyths.com. And then, Anthony, do you have a time frame about when the bigger book, Big Pharma, is coming out?
I'm trying to not think about it in those terms anymore because it just keeps on growing in scope. So I'm writing regular articles, and it will be ready when it's ready. In the meantime, get the e-book, and I will put out another book, you know, maybe 100 pages, 120 pages as an intermediate step before the big book comes out, because I think that big book is kind of going to become a
like
reference
the Bible.
Book. Yeah, it's going to become the book that everyone ends up going to for really, I'm going to give a panoramic understanding of what's going on in healthcare that tackles it from many different angles. So it's worth putting the time into. In the meantime, I'm sure people will enjoy following the articles I put out as they surface in more.
Oh, that's great.
Months.
That's
also,
great. And then... Oh, I was going to say, if people want to donate to your work on your page, is that secure? Like, you know, how do they know that's secure?
It uses the normal mechanisms that most websites use. You know, it's basically a straight payment system. So that's what's used for most e-commerce. So, you know, it's cheaper than PayPal and a lot of other services. So there is the option when you go on to 7pharmamyths.com to download the ebook for free, or leave a contribution if you like what I'm doing, because unlike pharma reps, I'm not getting paid six figures to write this book. I'm not getting paid anything to write this book. Unlike psychiatrists, I'm not getting paid six figures to poison people with drugs that have been shown to be ineffective and cause harm in the long term. So if you want to help, your contributions are certainly welcome, and they go quite a long way in Mexico. Also, someone might think, I like the way that guy sees the world. Maybe he's a good counselor for me, and you can contact me through social media if you think I'd be a good therapist for you, or go to beyourselfandloveit.com schedule a preliminary session through that website, if that's something that you thought might interest you. Thank you so much for having me on your show, Dr. Karen. You've been such a great, gracious host and really thought-provoking questions, and it was nice to hear a little bit of your own experience and how you see the world. And I admire your courage and your discernment and your dedication to the truth.
Thank you, Anthony. It's been a pleasure being with you today, and I want to thank all of our Light Medicine community and Light Warriors for tuning in. Until next time, lots of love and bye for now.